Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Earlier this year, Colombia, South America, was big news. It played host to the annual Summit of the Americas. But much of the media coverage, and much of what we might remember from that April meeting of leaders from the Western Hemisphere, is a Secret Service sex scandal. Today, a look at Colombia from another angle, how the drug trade is influencing the country's music and the broader issue of displacement and exile. We're joined by Dr. Diana Rodriguez Quevedo. She teaches in the Foreign Language Department at the University of Evansville, and she recently gave a lecture at the university titled Skipping Beats, The Impact of the Illegal Drug Trade on Colombian Music. Welcome to The Trend.
Thank you, Micah.
And we are in a few moments going to listen to some of the music and examples of this. But I want to start by talking about this broader issue, and that is that Colombia is now ranked number one in the world for internal displacement or internal exile of its population.
That's correct. And although I've read some recent articles in different newspapers, and it still shows that it's second to Sudan, but from Colombian statistics, it ranks first. Hmm. And this is due to reasons of violence by either paramilitary groups, guerrilla groups, and also the national military, and also transnational corporations who are going in, and local corporations and businesses trying to go in and exploit the land, the resources under the land, and as well as trying to have monoculture cultivation.
Right, so single crop cultivation.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there's the drug trade as well that you know, uses these areas, rural areas that are kind of away from urban sectors to also grow marijuana and coca leaves, coca plants.
Right, which ultimately becomes cocaine.
Exactly.
So is the drug trade then filling sort of a vacuum or taking advantage of this destabilization that these other factors cause, or what's the relationship?
I think it's a combination. Having chaos in these rural areas then is and promoting kind of the exile and internal displacement then allows for the land to be available for then other companies to come in, and whether it's for petroleum or for other energy sources, hydroelectric dams. So there are different types of exploitation of the land that will come in. So chaos lends itself to get rid of people and then come in and take over. But drug trafficking, definitely, that has been more a means, has become a means for groups like FARC or ELN and paramilitary to kind of subsidize their other activities.
These are resistance or guerrilla organizations.
Yes, the FARC and ELN are left-wing, while the paramilitary are considered right-wing.
And they're duking it out with whom?
Amongst themselves. And then there's the military as well. So it's a number of groups, and it's hard to say who's on whose side, who's really supporting the peasants or the indigenous or Afro-Colombians, who are the ones that are mainly impacted by the violence and by the drug trafficking.
Right, because it's the poor who are ultimately forced off their land and displaced.
Correct.
And is racism a part of this at all?
It is indirectly. Colombia, racism is definitely a part of the way groups such as the indigenous and the Afro descendants have been treated, have been dealt with over generations. But Colombia actually has, in terms of laws, have some of the most progressive and supportive laws to provide land titles and human rights to indigenous, both indigenous and in the last 10 years also to Afro Colombians, but it just doesn't come into practice. So Afro-Colombian groups, entire communities have been given land titles, but before they actually have a right to return or to have use of their land, then they're displaced, whether, you know, because of the violence and because of the other circumstances. So it doesn't really happen.
Where do the displaced go?
They start off going from their farms and small plots of land in rural areas to small towns, to then mid-sized cities, but most of them end up in the larger cities, in Bogota, Cali, Medellin, in the main cities, because because they can't, there is, part of it is because of the discrimination in the smaller towns. They're not welcome. They're rejected. And then they end up with double or triple stigma, the stigma of being, especially for women, being women, being indigenous, and then being displaced. And along with the label of being displaced or desplazado comes all this doubt and criticism, pretty much finger pointing that whether you are supporting the guerrillas, you're supporting the paramilitary, you're part of, you grow these illicit plants. And so there's, most people just start to doubt whether they're truly displaced because they're victims or they're displaced because they're part of the larger problem. And so they end up in the cities where they don't know. They really have a life of farming, of fishing, of being really being one with the land and living in community. And so they're often displaced in small groups as families, and they just can't make sense of a life outside of their territory.
And you study, your doctoral work has been in studying, I guess, the expressions of displacement, right? The literature. You're not a political scientist. You teach literature and culture and so forth. So what are you looking at?
My dissertation dealt with questions of issues of space and identity. So how identity is transformed or disturbed somehow by changing location. And so it's generations, indigenous peasants and Afro-Colombians who have been in a land, who have never traveled outside of their territory, and how all of a sudden they're uprooted. And that's a term, desarraigo in Spanish, that really is illustrates better what the experience is of the displaced, because they're literally uprooted. It's generations, their entire culture and lifestyle is uprooted. And so how identity shifts from the whole experience of being victimized and then being treated as those who are the problem.
Mm. We've got a song that illustrates some of this. This is by displaced people, and let's take a listen, and then you can tell us about it.
Oye, me chocó.
So what's being expressed in this song?
This song is very interesting because the melody is not original. The melody actually is a composition by Jairo Varela. He started a band. It's a big orchestra, actually, a salsa band called Nietzsche. And this has actually become the informal anthem of Chocó, of the Department of Chocó, which is
state.
Yes, it's on the Pacific coast of Colombia, and it's one of the areas that is mostly, the population is primarily Afro-Colombian, and they have been affected the most by violence and displacement, so the Afro-Colombian communities in the rural areas. And so Deyanira Mosquera, she's part of one of 23 communities that were displaced in 1997. So it was hundreds and hundreds of families that were displaced as an exodus due to the internal violence. The military came in to fight off the guerrillas, and then the paramilitary came in to push away the guerrillas. And so it became just this big mess, and the civilians were the ones who ended up being victimized. So it's not just displacement. There is also a lot of corruption, disappearances, rapes, and so everything else that comes with plundering of the land of the Afro descendants.
We're going to listen to some music that takes on and expresses some of those issues as we continue our conversation with Dr. Diana Rodriguez Quevedo. She's from the University of Evansville. You're listening to The Trend. We'll have more in a minute after a break.
This is The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and online at WNIN.org. Support for the program today comes through a grant from the Charles and Jan Stimftonagle family, who encourage your support of public broadcasting.
I'm Micah Schweitzer. You're listening to The Trend, and we're talking with University of Evansville professor Dr. Diana Rodriguez Quevedo. She studies displacement and exile in Colombia, and we're listening to music influenced by those issues and the country's drug trade. And let's jump in now with one by a group called Los Rangers del Norte, and this is a corrido de Ramón Isaza is the name of it.
Vecino humilde de Sonsón, Antioquia, es la persona a la que ahora quieren tener. Extraditado a los Estados Unidos, porque fue quien más vio crecer a la Sauce. Estoy hablando del señor Ramón Isaza, quien comenzó combatiendo a...
And there's that name that's in the title, Ramón Isaza, and so this is a song in honor of him.
Yes, and many of the narcocorridos or corridos prohibidos, as they're called in Colombia, are glorifying either drug lords or paramilitary leaders or guerrilla leaders. And so this has been the tradition, and it originates in Mexico with the Mexican Revolution. They were corridos, so honoring the great leaders of the Mexican Revolution. And through the drug trade later on in the 20th century, that music flew up. It came along to Colombia, and it was appropriated.
And what strikes me is this, this music sounds like what you might hear if you go have lunch at a Mexican restaurant, right? This is not sinister sounding music.
Exactly. And the tracks I brought in to share don't have those very crass and kind of lyrics, but a lot of their songs are, very vulgar. The lyrics are very vulgar and really tell some horrible tales.
Who sings this music?
It's primarily male-dominated industry. There are also some females. Some are just musicians who, and I'll quote Rey Fonseca, who says this is music that is very easy to write. And so some musicians who haven't made it big in other areas. And Alirio Castillo, who used to work for a very large record industry in the 1980s, left that record industry and then started up his own, and he rounded up all those who had at some point auditioned to have their music put out there, and so he rounded them up, and it's many musicians who either haven't made it big in other genres, and so they'll also try to by glorifying a drug trafficker, and that they try also to get special favors by mentioning them. So there's also other types of benefits and favors that happen.
Dangerous, though. I've heard of, in Mexico at any rate, songwriters who've written in honor of drug lords getting killed.
And that's a risk, that definitely. And so some of them may not speak directly of drug traffickers or Pablo Escobar and such, but then they'll talk about other events surrounding that, other musicians or even guerrilla members, and so without having to take sides specifically.
So this is not, this is music in honor of. This is not protest music, or maybe in some cases it's neutral, as you're saying, but who listens to this then? I mean, who's the audience?
Mainly youth, a lot of youth in LA. There's a very large audience in LA, in the youth of LA, but also in Colombia, it's more some of the poor populations.
And what do you think is the outcome of listening to this kind of music?
That's actually, there was an interview done to someone who studies specifically the narcocorridos of Mexico. And his answer really was that as you mentor and you guide your children or your teenagers in any kind of music or in any activity in life, it depends. Parenting is really important when it comes to that. And he, from what he was saying, there isn't a direct correlation. I guess you can compare it to Metallica and other music with subliminal messages. These are more direct messages. But, and so, yes, the first CD that was ever put out was in 1987, and it was dedicated to drug trafficking. Since then, there has been one volume every year, and it sells very well.
Yeah, we've got volume 12 on the table here, and it's got a really interesting cover. It has images of people I recognize. I see Osama bin Laden. I see President George W. Bush. It looks like the World Trade Center is exploding in the background there. Some disturbing images, and half of everybody's face is sort of an X-ray image showing their skull, so through their skin. What's going on this cover?
My interpretation, I see Chavez and even Uncle Sam are there, and Tiro Fijo is one of the main leaders of the FARC, Sure Shot. I would say that they are criticized. It's not maybe not protest, but there is high criticism of the corruption in Colombia. So this music and some of the main interpreters and composers of these songs claim to be telling the truth, and that some days this music will serve as historical documents to state what the rest of the media has not dared to say about the lives and the events happening around the drug trade and also in the legal system in Colombia and other areas in the military and such.
Let's listen to one more track. This one talks about a drug mule, somebody who carries drugs.
En la celda 23 está encerrada una dama sentenciada por la ley. La agarraron con la carga en sus entrañas y por eso le aplicaron de una vez la ley 30 con todos sus comodines.
So this talks about somebody who carries drugs, and I guess they come to a sticky end?
Correct, yes. So she does end up in jail, and then she ends up pregnant, whether it's because she was it was voluntary or not, she was raped or not in jail or outside of jail, and then she has a baby in jail. And this is very common. Just a couple of years ago, there was a big soap opera in Colombia that really depicted all the ins and outs of the drug trade and how women often are the main victims. It's part of circumstantial, women in rural areas who don't find any other way, any other employment opportunities, and that who think they can save and help their families by doing one or two trips to, you know, to the U.S. or Canada or Europe with carrying cocaine.
I want to come around to something you said a few moments ago, and that is that these serve as historical documents to tell what is not being told. What do you think the world needs to know about, and especially, I mean, America, the U.S. has a free trade agreement with Colombia. What does the world need to know about what's happening there and what should happen as a result of knowing these things?
I think we need to go beyond statistics, beyond how many millions of dollars are used to fight the drug war, and to really hear that it's personal stories. And some of these songs, actually, from my perspective, they serve that way. They have names. They tell a very particular story of a human being. And so as they're not very well seen in the public eye. Regular radio stations do not play these songs. And so, but I do think there is a space for them because they do tell, whether it's all true or not, at least it gives another perspective of a more human side of the story.
Dr. Diana Rodriguez Quevedo is a professor in the Modern Languages Department or the Foreign Languages Department at the University of Evansville. She was a recent speaker in the university's Andiron Lecture Series. Her talk was titled Skipping Beats, the Impact of the Illegal Drug Trade on Colombian Music. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing these stories with us.
It was my pleasure, Micah. Thank you.
You're listening to The Trend, and it's on now to our mid-show B segment. And associate producer Tony Voss today has something to do with the fleeting remnants of summer.
Yeah, that's right. This week we've got essayist Scott Solman back again, and he's lamenting the waning summer and the days gone by when a young Scott's time was spent playing America's other pastime.
I watched filmmaker Ken Burns' documentary Baseball again, and once again was reminded how Burns committed an unforgivable error. He failed to acknowledge wiffle ball. As a wiffle ball purist, I have long believed that the real reason baseball was invented was so someone could come up with its plastic counterpart. Wiffle ball is the plastic version of baseball, baseball light. First manufactured and sold in 1953, the plastic ball with its oblong hose is so user-friendly that practically anyone can join the fun. Wiffle ball is safe, doesn't require an irksome batting helmet or fielder's glove, and is easy on the wallet. What's also nice is you don't need a large vacant lot to hold a game with wiffle ball because the lightweight ball is designed for confined areas. With wiffle ball, almost anyone's backyard can become a Wrigley Field of the mind. In the early 70s, wiffle ball was childhood religion on Brushy Fork Road. We'd start our games early enough to feel dew on our bare feet. Double cola cartons and fruit tree saplings were our bases, and home plate was a bald spot among the clover. Imagination transformed the roof of our ranch house into the center field stands, inspiring us to swing for the shingles. A ball hit on the roof was a home run, but the batter was caught out if the ball rode down the roof fast enough to ramp clear of the gutter and land in the outfielder's hands. Four foul balls and you were out. This should be the rule for real baseball, to alleviate the monotony of a major league game. If someone had the forethought to holler automatic pitcher before the game, he or she became just that, automatic pitcher. Walks weren't allowed. If a pop fly became trapped in the limb of the mimosa, the outfielders were allowed to shake the tree, free the ball, and catch it for an out. If the teams had three or fewer players on each side, we channeled ghost runners. When a ball was in play, fielders had the option to throw it at the base runner. And if contact was made before the runner reached the base, the runner was called out. This, too, would make major league games more interesting. The plastic ball was as harmless as a sweat bee sting and seldom left marks on your skin that lasted more than 30 seconds. Hours later, we'd still be in the middle of some game, the 20th of the day, our faces tilted to the stars upon hearing that glorious plastic pop of bat meeting ball, our eyes searching for some well-hit wiffle ball sailing through the cool night like some polyurethane comet high above our field of plastic dreams. If you listened close enough, you could hear the breathy sound the ball made, part whistle, part wheeze, as it passed overhead. Chasing the sound, you dove shirtless and heroically belly-surfed across the slick night grass, looking up just in time to see the white sphere descend in quirky motions and land in the bare folds of your upturned hands. As the batter moaned in despair and the automatic pitcher cheered and the chiggers chewed your skin and your belly burned from the slide, you knew you would never experience a more memorable game-winning catch in your life. And one day, when you were much older and terribly nostalgic, you would write about it. For old time's sake, I recently bought a wiffle ball for my 1-year-old son. I'm happy to report that he shows interest in the gift and can throw a wicked drill ball to his proud dad. I have a good feeling that wiffle ball will be around for some time. I can't wait until he can swing a plastic bat.
Little boy in a baseball hat stands in the field.
I'd like to pride myself on the fact that this is the second time I've got Kenny Rogers on the show. You can see Scott Salmon performing live at the next Will Reed and Sing for the Cure show with special Evansville guests Stan Levko and Kristen Tucker on October 7th at Kimball International Corporate Headquarters in Jasper. The show benefits the Susan G. Komen Foundation. And check out the Trends Facebook page where I've posted a link to some information about how Wiffle Ball got started. Thanks, Micah.
Thank you, Tony. You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Somehow, The Trend has been on the air for a year now, and we have not yet talked about beer. So today, a look at the art and science of beer brewing. Beer is the most popular alcoholic beverage in the U.S., and around 1,700 breweries of various sizes satisfy the demand. In Evansville, which was once home to a number of breweries, the ranks are growing again. In the coming months, two new craft breweries will open, Tin Man Brewing and Carson's Brewery. And none of this accounts for all the non-commercial breweries in people's homes. So we're joined now by two members of the Ohio Valley Home Brewers Association. John Mills is the president. Welcome to The Trend.
Thank you.
And Don Heisler, the vice president. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And I'll put it to you, John. What is beer?
Well, beer is a alcoholic beverage that is made from water, yeast, malted barley, and hops.
Just those things?
Those four things. Germany's actually got a law specifically stating that beer can only contain those four items.
Right. It's the purity law of 15-something or other, right? It goes back quite a ways.
Reinishgebot, yes, 1615.
Yeah. 1615, okay, yeah. And so you somehow managed to get a huge range of beverages out of just those ingredients. What accounts for all the different directions you can take that?
Well, the difference from the different beers are just according to how much of one ingredient, specifically like the barley and the hops, you would use in each specific beer. I mean, just a normal everyday drinking beer might contain 99% of just one type of malted barley. Mm-hmm.
But you add different types, and then you get different complex flavors and all that sort of thing.
There's basic what's called a two-row, mm-hmm. which is the base grain. And you can have wheat. You can have rye. There's different grains of barley even as far as how well it was kilned by being dried and roasted. You got dark roasted malts. You got malts that can give you flavors of raisins, plum, caramel flavors. I mean, there's a wide range.
And you do tastings at the Ohio Valley Homebrewers Association, Don.
Oh, yeah, that's part of our best part. We have a good turnout for that. Everybody likes to bring what they've made, and we all enjoy sampling it and critiquing everybody else's beer.
And so do you use these, you could say beer snob tasting terms? Oh, I've got, wet dog in this sip here and raisins in that sip. And
We do, but we've all started, and it's a learning curve when you make beer, and we've all enjoyed tasting everybody's beer and watching them grow with their beer.
And I understand you used to have like a style of the month or a beer of the month that you used to do, and now you do a bad beer of the month. What's the idea behind that?
It's more of an off flavor. We've all made beer that's had some kind of off flavor.
Or flaw. Yeah. Because a lot of people in the club have already learned that there's an IPA, India Pale Ale, and then there's a Russian Imperial Stout or 84 different styles of beer out there.
84?
Yes, according to Beer Judge Certification Program, BJCP Style Guidelines. But so we went to, instead of just introducing beer to people, we wanted to help them with their home brewing and making their beer better. So these flaws or off flavors are specifically, it could be like Band-Aid flavors or
that's true
or Barnyard or I mean buttered popcorn is an off flavor.
That sounds better than Barnyard.
Yeah.
Sure. Or Band-Aid.
And these are picked up in different parts of the making of the beer. Some in fermenting too high, some in not having enough yeast. Maybe you're not your equipment's not sterile enough, and you can learn by what you're doing wrong or what you need to improve on by knowing about what it tastes like.
There seems to be a lot of science involved. I mean, it's chemistry of sorts.
It's chemistry. It's cooking. We like to call it cooking. You know, if you're a good cook, you're a good beer maker.
Uh-huh.
I like to say it's more like a doctor practicing medicine because you're working with the live organism, yeast,
yeah.
And most of the time it behaves like you're going to expect it, but then there's always the oddball that may not act that way. So it's taking science and the art of a living organism and making it more of a practice.
And that yeast, I guess you can use different strains of yeast, right? It's not just, this is not bread yeast, I guess.
Right. It's a beer. It's a yeast cultivated for beer. And there's all types of different varieties that give you different tastes. You make a Bavarian wheat, which uses a unique yeast. When I make a Bavarian wheat, I'll use that yeast. I will use the same exact grains and a different yeast to make an American wheat. And it has a complete different taste.
Because, I mean, back to those off flavors, some of the off flavors are acceptable for a certain style. Like we said, the Band-Aid flavor, some of the Belgian beers with the yeast that's used in there give those flavors, and to that certain level, that is acceptable. But I mean, in a Budweiser beer, that's not acceptable.
Gotcha. I see. Well, let's sort of back it up, and we know what our ingredients are now. How do you take these ingredients? What happens? I guess you start with a big pot of water on a stove. Is that the starting point?
Well, for home brewing, there's basically two methods, now three methods, of making the beer at home. You've got the extract, which is kind of like if you can boil water and add potato flakes to make instant potatoes, there's extract for beer also like that. And then there's all grain, which you take your grain and you get it, your malted barley, and you get it cracked, and then you steep it for a while. But then there's also the brew-in-a-bag method, which is very similar to the all-grain, because you're using all-grain. But instead of, like, what's called lautering, which is pouring water through your grain to kind of rinse them, the brew-in-a-bag method is you don't do the rinse. You just have all your grain in the bag, and you just pick the bag up like a tea bag, and your beer is ready to be boiled at that point. But the actual process of making beer is, yes, you have to boil at some point, and then you add your hops to that. It takes 60 minutes to get the full bitterness from a hop, to get that full bitterness. But where you add your hops at in there is called a hopping schedule, and then that can determine where you get some of that hoppy characteristics. You get bitterness, you can get aroma, you get the flavor, and you can get the big nose for it then at the end.
And hops, I guess, can account for very different flavors in beers.
Oh, there's many different varieties of hops, and they're even developing new ones today. What was it, 5 years ago, there was a hop shortage?
Right.
And you should have seen the home brewers go wild on trying to find out who can grow hops and where can we find hops from, because we can't make beer. Hops was, originally, I think they used to use pine cones and other things like that to bitter the beer. When you make homebrew, it is a sweet liquid. Unless you use something like a hop to bitter it up some. It's too sweet to actually drink.
Really?
And that's what the hops do. They give it the character. They bitter the beer up. They don't necessarily just make a bitter beer, but they bitter it up from what the original
To give form. It some balance.
Yeah.
I see. So, and there's a huge range because, you know, to go back to your Budweiser, mm-hmm. it has hops in it, but that's not a really hoppy, bitter beer. On the other hand, you could drink some sort of an India Pale Ale and, you know, it might hit you over the head with the amount of hops.
Yeah, it's a different style Correct. Hops, different amount of hops, different boil time. And you can take the same beer again and use different hops and come up with a different style beer.
With so many different styles, is beer one often hears about it being a love it or hate it kind of a beverage, but if there are so many different styles, is there something for everyone?
Yeah, it's always interesting to hear somebody say, oh, I don't like anything but Bud Coors or Miller, and you get them to come to an event and we'll have a red ale or something like that, which is a mild ale, low in hops, and they'll taste it and they said, I've never tasted a beer like that, you know, and you get them to just have a little bit more body in the beer. And that's always interesting.
But there's also a lot of people who don't have a lot of experience with different beers. I know with the tastings we've been doing with Carson's Brewery, trying to get a feel for what this general area of Evansville will prefer for a beer. We've had fruit beers. We've had even hoppy beers. And what you might think somebody would like, which is just a normal Bud, Miller, or Coors drinker, you know, we give them a raspberry wheat beer, and they're like, well, I would probably drink that too.
If there are, as I mentioned at the start, 1,700 breweries, and you're adding another one, so then make it 1,701 once Carson's Brewery opens up, why brew at home if there's so much beer available?
Well, brewing at home is just like cooking. I mean, sure, you can eat out all the time, but it's nice. You can have your own hand in there, and it's something you've created.
We're talking with John Mills and Don Heisler from the Ohio Valley Home Brewers Association. More after a break. You're listening to The Trend.
This is The Trend here on WNIN.org and 88.3 WNIN-FM. A reminder that on Saturday, September 15th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., it's the WNIN Kids Fest, sponsored by Bunny Bread, the Cat in the Hat, Curious George, and many other PBS Kids characters will be here at the WNIN studios in downtown Evansville. Bring your kids or grandkids and join in all the fun because the event is free and open to the public. There's lots more information at our website, WNIN.org. Now, of course, if you're listening to the replay of The Trend on Sunday afternoon, want to let you know that the Kids Fest was a whole lot of fun and a big success, and if you enjoyed it, thanks for coming, and if you didn't get to come, well, you missed out.
I'm Micah Schweitzer. You're listening to The Trend. We're talking beer with John Mills and Don Heisler from the Ohio Valley Homebrewers Association. And so a minute ago we talked about, you got to boil something and you add your hops at some point and you've got this nice mixture going, but then there's a point where you can't just let it cool and ladle it into a cup. You've got to let it ferment or it's not beer, right?
That's right. That's what's called fermenting. And you'll take your beer and you'll ferment it in a carboy, which most of us use.
What's a carboy?
It's a glass container. Now they've got plastic also that are food grade.
Water jug.
Like a big water jug.
Okay.
You'll have a stopper on it, an air lock, and you'll put that in a conditioned area for anywhere from 4 days to 4 weeks, depends on the beer. And that point is when you add your yeast. That's the exact point. It's called beer. Once you've added your yeast to your wort, then it's classified as beer.
Wort.
So that is the liquid that you boil, and at that point, it's not called beer until you've added the yeast to it, technically.
That's a lot of people will think, you know, they'll see me, and it's like, what are you doing? Oh, we're brewing beer. Okay, so when's it going to be ready? Later today? Well, actually, I mean, about the quickest you can get from grain to glass is about 2 weeks. And so, I mean, that's for a lighter beer. Those are ales. Those ferment quicker and at a warmer temperature. Lagers take longer because that's a bottom fermenting yeast, and they ferment cooler. Ales would be 2 to 4 weeks, and lagers can be anywhere from 4 weeks to 8 weeks.
You know, as someone who's never brewed beer but certainly has an appreciation for it, it always seems like you have to have such precise conditions. I mean, there's sterilization, and there's, you know, you got to cook the thing right, and then you've got to have the right temperature, and that there are just a lot of variables that have to be controlled.
It's very forgiving. You might be amazed.
Yeah.
Brewing methods, Belgian styles, yeah. They cool their beer in what's called cool ships because they don't have these fancy machines and everything to cool the beer down to where you can put the yeast in there. So what they'll do is they'll actually pump their boiling wort into cool ships, which is a thin metal pan that might take up the entire floor of the attic.
Wow.
And they open up the eaves and let the night air cool it overnight. Well, all that time, that sweet sugary syrup is open to any kind of critters that like to eat it. And that's what gives those specific beers their general taste. That's what people seek out.
A Band-Aid falls into it.
You get that
Band-Aid. You get the Band-Aid flavor. So we're talking about adding yeast to really make it beer. And I guess you can buy yeast, but but it is a living organism.
It is an organism. I myself keep beer alive all the time in my refrigerator, and I cultivate it, propagate it, pass it on. I've even taken yeast out of a store-bought bottle of beer, grown that yeast up into the amount I needed to make a clone of that beer. Yeast gets expensive. It's one of the fairly expensive parts of the beer, especially when you might need 2 packs of yeast for the amount of sugar that your beer has to be able to, for it to do its job properly. So that's just another aspect. And the type of yeast makes a difference on the taste of the beer.
Well, since you've brought up cost, what are we talking about? What's your per? I mean, if you can buy a good microbrew for, say, you know, $8 or $9 for a 6-pack, what are you looking at for your 6-pack?
$20 to $45 for 50 bottles, generally. That's not including the bottles, which you figure are you're reusing.
So that's 50 cents a bottle, basically.
Yeah, an average light ale. I think that's what my cost, because I sort of track that with the program I have, and I can do it that price. You can probably do it cheaper if you.
But there's the labor and the time involved with it. It's not necessarily the price all the time, but that's, I mean, when I first got into home brewing 15 years ago, that was the reason really why I got into it as, you know, a poor college student. You know, wanted to drink the nice beers. Just couldn't afford to do that on a daily basis. So home brewing was the thing for me.
And the equipment?
The equipment, I mean, you can do it as simply as if you got a spaghetti pot at home that'll hold 4 quarts of water, you can make you a gallon of beer at a time. So it's not necessarily, you don't have to have a ginormous pot.
Mm. And then you need that carboy to let it ferment in.
Or that carboy. I mean, there's different jugs. I mean, if you can sanitize it so that you know, I mean, you can really, there's a lot of forgiveness in the beer. So, I mean, you don't have to have fancy equipment. I mean, I found a 5-gallon water cooler on the side of the road one day, and I turned that into a mash tun with $1.50 worth of parts from the local hardware store.
Ah. Now, on the other end of the spectrum is breweries, which spend all kinds of money on fancy equipment. And you're taking this homebrew hobby pro now, working with Carson's Brewery. Tell us a little bit about what this brewery is going to be. Where is it?
Well, Carson's Brewery is not in existence yet as far as the building. It's going to be a brand new construction of building, brand new brewery equipment that's going to be put in. So it's going to take a little time for that. We're going to be located on Lynch Road, like right behind St. Mary's. In between St. Mary's and Wayne Supply, there's a little service road that goes back to an existing company, Chem Group, and we're going to be located on the same basic property area as them. But it's going to probably take probably close to a year before everything is completed that way. But we're in the process now of getting our current equipment, which is a small test batch size, in licensing so we can get the federal approval and everything for that.
And how much demand for microbrewed beer is there in this area?
Evansville market is really behind the times for the rest of America as far as the demand for craft or imported beer. Evansville is about 3% of the general market is craft beer drinkers, where the rest of the country is about 10%. Mm. So there is a lot of room for growth for Evansville. And you can see it, that's, you know, with Tin Man, that's going to be opening up here soon. Taroni's been in existence for quite a while. And now with Carson's Brewery. I believe at one time, Evansville used to be home to 12 major breweries at one time.
With all the German heritage, so that's not surprising, I guess, right? Well, who drinks beer and who likes to brew it? I mean, are there demographic profiles that you can draw?
We have VPs of banks. We have service technicians. We have kids in college that are coming and want to learn how to make beer.
You say kids, they're women. All over 21.
Yeah, they told us they were. We have women that are out and help and like to make beer with their husbands. It's a wide range.
Well, there's a chance to sample microbrewed, homebrewed, and imported beers coming up next weekend, Saturday, September 29th in the evening. It's the Evansville Museum Contemporary's annual Brew Ha Ha at the Evansville Museum, and you guys are going to have a stand or a booth there, and people can try some of the beers. And we've been talking with John Mills. He's the president of the Ohio Valley Homebrewers Association, and Don Heisler, the vice president. Thanks both to you for so much for coming in and for sharing your passion and your knowledge.
Oh, we love to talk about beer.
Almost as much as you like to drink it.
Almost.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Trend on WNIN-FM and WNIN.org. Support for the program today comes from the Evansville Day School, presenting Discover the Upper School Difference, a program to assist parents and students considering high school options. The October 24th program at Evansville Day School features dinner, tours, and a chance to meet the faculty. Information on scholarships and financial aid will be available. Learn more at 476-3039 or evansvilledayschool.org.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and time now to wrap things up with the Arts Notebook. Roger McBain from the Courier and Press is here. Hey, Roger.
Good afternoon.
And boy, lots of stuff going on, but I want to start with this great story that you have, that's sort of a circle of life story about an actress who's now playing the mother of the character she played 23 years ago.
Sherry Sherrard Jackson, who's always been one of my favorite local actresses. Played in L.A., New York before returning to Evansville, and she played the role of Shelby in the Evansville premiere of Steel Magnolias when Repertory People of Evansville did it in 1989. Now she's back as Malin, that character's mother, in Evansville Civic Theater's production, which is opening tonight. It's a role she said she wanted to play ever since she was first in that show 2 decades ago. And for people who don't know, this is a dramedy celebrating Southern sisterhood in a small town in Louisiana in a beauty parlor. It plays weekends through September 30th at Evansville Civic Theater.
And there's more theater happening over at the Lincoln Amphitheater. And the show that they're opening has an intriguing name.
The Musical Comedy Murders of 1940. It's not actually a musical, but it's definitely a fast-paced killer comedy about theater producers set in 1940, set in a wealthy theater backer's home. And the action goes through doors, windows, and several moving bookcases. It's a community theater production. First-time direction by Kyle Rupert of Jasper. It opens tonight, and it runs through September 22nd.
And, of course, that's outdoors, so let's hope the nice weather holds.
Well, it's a covered amphitheater, so it doesn't matter.
Okay, rain or shine.
Right.
Now, speaking of nice weather, this weekend's shaping up nicely, and apparently this is a prime weekend for festivals. So let's move along from east to west, starting over in Ferdinand.
The Ferdinand Folk Festival starts tomorrow at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time in Ferdinand's 18th Street Park. It's going to have several musical acts, including Colin Hay, a former Aussie rock band Men at Work member, those guys who drank too much and made chunder. That's tomorrow.
And then moving a little bit to the west, to Evansville, two festivals.
A couple things tomorrow. The Jazz and Wine Festival on Main Street will feature 16 bands on 3 stages, 9 wineries. And then right here in the Carpenter House, the WNIN Kids Fest will have mascots, music, stories, and other activities, including belly dancing, I see.
Something for everyone.
Okay.
And then over in New Harmony, there's a festival there as well.
Kunstfest, which means arts festival in German. Celebration of German arts, crafts, food, heritage. 150 vendors' booths there doing demonstrations, a liars contest, some ballet dancers, and that's Saturday and Sunday.
And I know that both of us in our jobs should know better than to editorialize, but Roger, am I alone in finding it frustrating that so many events get piled into one weekend?
I think probably those people who insist that there's nothing to do in Evansville must hate it worse than you.
Well, it would be nice if they were spread out, if we could go to all of them. Yeah. Now, last year, The Trend talked with the producers of a web TV series. It's called The Book of Dallas. And some pretty big news for them. It's a local production that goes national starting next week.
On Monday, www.coldcast.tv will put up the first of 10 episodes of a web TV series about an atheist who dies only to be resurrected by God, sent back to Earth to write and promote a new Bible that doesn't turn theology into a reason to fight, kill, judge, or I guess incite embassy burnings as well.
Yeah, it certainly seems timely, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. And that's that was produced by Joe Atkinson and Marks Pyle, who we had on the show. You can find that show if you want to hear them in our archives at WNIN.org. And by the way, that's Coldcast TV, as in cold with a K, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And finally, a series of organ recitals that starts this week, Roger.
The monthly noon organ concert series in the University of Evansville's new chapel begins 12:10 p.m., 10 after noon on Thursday, with The Genius of Bach, featuring Douglas Reed playing the Toccata and Fugue in D minor.
And then there's a series of these ongoing in future weeks, focusing on different composers and so forth.
Running over the months ahead. Yeah, that's right.
That's great. That's so that's at the University of Evansville at the New Chapel. And you can find out more about all of these events and even other things happening in Roger McBain's articles. Those are in Thursday's and Sunday's edition of the Evansville Courier and Press. And, of course, they're online as well at courierpress.com. Roger, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, next week we're going to have a politics roundtable and look at what's going on in state and national and regional politics. And we'll also celebrate the 99th anniversary of Evansville's historic Alhambra Theater. You can send us feedback and questions for the show. Just click on the trend at WNIN.org, and you'll find links there for getting in touch on Facebook, Twitter, and by email. So we'd love to hear from you through any of those means. Weekly podcasts are at our website, WNIN.org. You can also find them at CourierPress.com. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes and in the NPR podcast directory. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Ryan Reynolds is our producer at the Courier and Press. Tony Voss is our associate producer and engineers the show. The theme music you're hearing was written by Jeffrey Osman. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk again next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.